Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Diana Wiley. I'm your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. Well, it's that time of year again when Americans baste turkeys, bake pies, and give thanks. Yes, we're doing that because we're about 2 days away from Thanksgiving. Do you have an attitude of gratitude? My guest, Dr. Richard Wagner, certainly does. Welcome once again to this program, Dr.
Hey, Diana,
Richard Wagner.
Good to be back. Good to be back. Thank you.
Thank you. You were on Love, Lust, and Laughter a year ago. You were on twice, and we mainly spoke about one of your books, The Amateur's Guide to Death and Dying, Enhancing the End of Life. And so we're not going to talk about that one today, but we had a very good discussion, and it is archived, everybody, from November the 5th and November the 12th of last year, 2013. Very good information was given. Another book of yours is The Gospel of Kink, and we're going to tie that in to this program. But you have some thoughts about gratitude, and I knew you would, and that's why I invited you back, because you have some really good tie-ins with rituals for love and, wait for this, everybody, BDSM, aftercare. And we haven't talked about BDSM very much on this program, so we will today.
Good.
What did you say, Richard?
Good.
Yes, I think so, too. And, you know, I know you because you're in Seattle, and we've met, and we are certainly friends, acquaintances. And colleagues, yes, because you're a psychotherapist, a clinical sexologist in private practice since 1981. And what I think is very fascinating about you is you're a former Catholic priest.
That and the $1.50 gets me a ride on the bus, don't you know?
I bet it does. Before we get into this discussion about gratitude and sort of Thanksgiving in 2 days and BDSM and so on, what was it like to be a Catholic priest, and what made you leave?
Well, as a matter of fact, I didn't leave.
Oh.
Technically, I'm still a priest.
You are.
Yeah, but I, of course, don't practice anymore.
Right.
And the reason that I was dismissed from my religious community was back in 1981 when I finished my doctorate in clinical sexology. I'd written my doctoral dissertation about the sexual attitudes and behaviors of gay Catholic priests in the active ministry. And as I said, this was back in 1981 before there was such a thing as gay priests. Of course, they've
existed forever.
And so I was labeled the gay priest, don't you know? So, like, if there wasn't anyone. So of course, you know, this was the conclusion of my studies, my doctoral studies, and my religious community had paid for all of my education, and they knew what I was studying. But as soon as there was the first wrinkle of publicity, and there was a deluge all over the world. This was groundbreaking kind of stuff, and I had broken the code of silence, and I was to be punished, and indeed I was.
They kicked you out.
Basically, they kicked me out of my religious community, yes.
So did you tie into your thesis some of the pedophilia stuff that was going on with gay priests?
I knew of it, and that was one of the reasons that I was studying. I was thinking that if we could change our understanding about human sexuality, particularly about gay sexuality, in the church, then we'd be much better positioned to talk about other kinds of sexuality, and particularly the sexuality that was really getting a lot of priests into trouble. and that was underage sexuality, sexual contact, and so yes, it, so I knew that that was going on, and at the time that it was going on, I was the you know, these priests were being shuffled about and, you know, reassigned, and they kept offending and whatnot, and there again this code of silence, and then but I, because I was public about, you know, this phenomenon of gay Catholic priests and what problems they were having in putting their two lives together, their gay identity and their priesthood, I was being publicly punished. So it was just, it was, the hypocrisy of it all was just astonishing to me.
But Richard, in hindsight, aren't you just as relieved you were kicked out?
At the time, you know, that was my whole life. It was everything I knew. I had worked toward that goal since I was 7 years old.
Wow,
single-minded.
I did not know this.
Yes, this was the only thing I ever wanted to do. And at the time, I didn't know this, but I had a terrible learning disorder. I was dyslexic. I didn't know anything about that. And all the, you know, the people I turned to for guidance just said, well, you know, Richard, you're never going to make it because you're just too stupid.
And, there were so many misunderstandings about dyslexia back then.
Right.
And
right.
I think so many who had dyslexia felt they were stupid because they couldn't sort out the words or the numbers or whatever.
Exactly the point. And so, you know, I battled an uphill battle to, you know, to get to ordination. That meant, you know, a graduate degree, you know, in theology. And so, and then I was, you know, put forward to do this doctoral program. In fact, I'm the only Catholic priest in the world with a doctorate in clinical sexology.
I bet that's true. Wow. That set you apart, Richard.
Yeah, and that really set me apart, both literally and figuratively. And so at the time, as I said, this was my whole life. My whole support system, everything that I knew, everything that I loved, was there in the church, and it was taken away from me in the twinkling of an eye, like overnight. They took away my car, my finances, my financial support, my insurance.
Everything
was
very
all
punishing.
So punitive. Yes, I couldn't act as a public minister. I was silenced from Rome, and it was devastating. It was, you know, this was the center of my life, and in the twinkling of an eye, as I said, it all went away. And I was devastated. I'm surprised, actually, that I lived through that. But the thing is that now, as I look back on it, you know, I am grateful. There's our word for today, our magic word. I am grateful for being released from this. Not that I chose to, but I acquiesced to their demands, basically. And, you know, I'm glad to be free of it. I have a deep spirituality in my life. I'm not a theist anymore, let alone a Christian or Catholic. But I have a deep sense of spirituality. And a good portion of that spirituality has to do with gratitude, interestingly enough.
Yes. So that's a pretty good segue into talking about, as you said, the magic word of the day, gratitude. When we spoke on the phone yesterday, it was officially a pre-interview, but it was also for you and I to get caught up. You spoke about the tie-ins that occur with gratitude, and one has to do with the rituals for love, and the other, which we'll deal with after the half-hour break, is, wait for it, BDSM aftercare. And so this should be very interesting for everybody to hear, because Dr. Richard, you have so much to offer. So talk about the rituals for love, and you have... In fact, I just saw a client 2 days ago, and he said, you know, he's struggling. He wants to be more successful on on online dating, and he's so kind of needy in some ways that he says, I love you too soon.
Right.
And you have a very good antidote to that. Would you talk about that?
Right. Well, I think one of the best ways to express one's deep feelings for another person, or even casual feelings for another person, is by thank you. I think we use the word words "I love you" way too much, and as your client is an example, often too soon, and so it makes them those words trite and empty. But we could easily replace them with "thank you" and heartfelt "thank you."
Yes, heartfelt, so that it is authentic.
It is. It's got to be authentic, you know, because, I mean, we're taught as children, and you were expressing your feelings about your grandchildren, you know, being so charming and sweet, you know, with their pleases and thank yous. We're taught that, and that becomes very rote, and that's a lovely thing. That's a very nice thing. But heartfelt gratitude is something completely different. It's that it's that gratitude that comes, you know, when a mother discovers her lost child, for example. I was at a park earlier this year, back in September, and there was a whole bunch of people, you know, milling around in Seward Park, and a mother had, you know, was doing something to her toddler in the walker, and her maybe 3 or 4 year old wandered off into the into the crowd, and she was hysterical.
Of course
she was.
It would be a nightmare.
Exactly, and as it turned out, you know, a fellow brought the little boy back to his mother, and you know, I mean, it was, you know, not a bad thing for the kid. I mean, he was just, you know, he got caught up, and the first things out of her mouth was, "Oh my God, thank goodness." Now, that's the kind of gratitude, that wholeheartedness, a man who survives a near-fatal car crash. Thank God, thank goodness. It's that completeness that, you know, that we're able to express our complete feelings of gratitude. There's the idea, I have a client who is a fetishist, and he's a cross-dresser, a straight man, and for the longest time he hid this from his partner, now his wife, and my counsel was, you know, talk to her about it, invite her to participate, and do this quid pro quo, this give to get sort of thing. If you join me in this, I will be eternally grateful, and I'll do something for you. I will express my gratitude to you in some very fundamental and physical sort of way, and that's what saved the day. I mean,
so how did it turn out?
Well, the wife, you know, she thinks it's kind of funny. You know, she didn't know how to handle it at first, and now, you know, she goes shopping with her husband, and you know, this is a very private thing. You know, it's only between them, and it's very structured. He can only do it at, you know, at certain times, and all this kind of, so he knows the ground rules, and but he's enormously grateful. And one of the things that the woman said, she says, you know, this is such a little gift that I can give to him, and he is so grateful in return. And you know, he certainly gives her lots of gifts as well, you know, and pampers her and whatnot. So, you know, it's an opportunity for us to just, you know, unload, you know, our sense of gratitude to somebody who is helping us with something that we really want to accomplish.
That's a beautiful story, and I've worked occasionally with cross-dressers, and the problem often is that the wife will not come on board.
Yeah.
She thinks it's really strange that her husband likes, and the misconception often is that the man is not heterosexual, but he most always is.
Yes.
But he has this kink, this fetish.
Exactly that.
And so, but if they can learn to play together, then, you know, I know this Norwegian couple, and they're both, well, he's an MD and is a regular cross-dresser, and she's a psychologist, and they're both sexologists in Norway. And they have accepted it so much that once a year they go on a trip together where he gets to cross-dress the whole week.
How wonderful.
And I don't know the details of their sex life, but apparently, you know, it's pretty robust.
Yeah.
Sometimes right. He's dressed as a woman, sometimes he isn't.
Right.
But it takes a certain amount of openness, doesn't it?
Right. But, I mean, just think about, you know, what kind of gift you could give your partner for, you know, just acceptance.
Acceptance.
And it's a way of loving. Certainly. And, you know, interestingly enough, it seems to me that we have more opportunities to say thank you, you know, in our lives than we do I love you, because, you know, we can be grateful for lots and lots more people than we can love.
Yes. Expand on that. You're so articulate, and you have a unique perspective that many don't have. So please, Richard, expand on that a little.
Well, it seems to me that one of the key components to real gratitude is that the person we are thankful for or to, we make them our equal. You cannot be actually thankful to somebody who you perceive as being less than you. If you have that sense, then your gratitude is not real gratitude. Gratitude actually raises up the person.
So, raises them up and gets them out of their ego.
Right, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And it gets us out of our ego, it seems to me, in the
yes.
act of gratitude. Our selfishness and our self-centeredness gets in the way of living an authentic life, it seems to me, and gratitude is the antidote to self-centeredness and selfishness.
Because the true narcissist really has trouble with compassion or empathy.
Oh, absolutely.
And you can't be entitled.
Right. And you can't be grateful. You know, and if I'm entitled something, then no one can actually give it to me as a gift, because it's my entitlement.
That's a good point, of course. You can't give the gift if the person already feels that they're entitled to it.
Right. Exactly.
They're not open. Yeah, expand a little bit more. You're giving us lots of philosophical, spiritual, really, the wisdom, things that people can think about at this time of year, and hopefully more than just this time of year.
One would hope so. I mean, there are all these rituals of, you know, gratitude. We touched on it just moments ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everything from a thank you card to a victory parade. You know, your team won, and you have this big victory parade in your town, or you have the national holiday that is Thanksgiving, and the award ceremony of, you know, peers, you know, acknowledging the superior work of another peer. You know, all of those kinds of things, that is a way of showing gratitude. But if we think that is already owed to us, that belongs to us by virtue of who we are, you know, then there is no gift. And when there is no gift, then it belittles the, you know, the whole experience, it seems to me.
So I'm thinking about the Academy Awards. And, of course, narcissism typically runs deep with celebrities.
Right. I want to thank all the little people.
But there are certain celebrities that seem more authentic than others.
Yes.
And often it's revealing in their acceptance speeches.
Yes.
Have you noticed that?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess it's really hard for some celebrities not to become self-absorbed and total narcissists because they get all this adulation.
Right.
And they, you know, and with the wealth And the entourage comes right. the expectation that they will be admired and revered and
right.
and that they are due it. They are owed it.
Right.
And I suppose that's one reason why there are lots of divorces. In,
yes.
I watch some of the reality television shows just here and there, little snippets. And boy, narcissism runs wild. I'm thinking
yeah.
of the Kardashians and,
yeah.
geez.
Yeah, it's kind of tragic. I mean, our culture adulates that, and it doesn't adulate gratuity or gratitude, and that's really unfortunate. It seems. I think it's one of the things that plagues our culture so much, and you know, money grubbing and you know, super wealth, and I mean. You know, how can you be grateful when you have everything?
Yeah.
And, you know, the funny thing, we said at the top of the show, you know, when I appeared on your show last time, we talked about death and dying, the work that I do there. And
right.
that's one of the things that I am most aware of, that people who have been, you know, have had a sense of gratitude in their life for all of their life have much less difficulty dying than people who have tons and tons of regrets. And I'm owed 75 years or I'm owed 80 years. Well, no, not at all. So it's such a tragedy where we could a very simple kind of thing of living our life in a particular sort of way that would be much more life-affirming and mindful than we currently are. And I think our society would be healthier.
Absolutely. And the end of life would be smoother.
Yes. Because as we talked about last time, you know,
yes.
it is part and parcel of living. And, you know, if we are grateful for not only the beautiful, wonderful things that happen in our life, you know, the birth of children and, you know, all the other things that, you know, we can be grateful for, we can also be grateful for the adversity because, you know, the adversity is, you know, what makes us. And, you know,
it deepens our character often.
Most assuredly.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I felt about my predicament with the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
And as painful as that was to me, it was the very thing that made me who I am today. And I like it. I like me.
Yeah.
I do. And I find myself saying that out loud. And you know, and I've taken to asking friends and colleagues and things like that. Do you like yourself? Do you admire yourself? And I take them up short. You know, that this is a question that they don't generally ask themselves, I guess. But if you can say that, you know, I admire myself. You know, I think I'm a good person. What a great testimony. I mean, other people must think the same thing, but it's nice if you can say it about yourself.
Well, yes, and then I think it can propel you even to more kindness and
absolutely.
Generosity.
Absolutely.
Because if you feel good about yourself, you want to give back.
Right.
And, I mean, my short prayer every day, and sometimes more than once a day, is, thank you, God, for all my blessings.
Yeah.
I know I have a blessed life. I have a beautiful love in my fiancé, Brian. I have satisfying work where I can make a difference in people's lives. I have healthy children and now grandchildren. And I mean, really, I'm so grateful, and I've always been that way. And I've also encouraged my clients to be grateful for each other, you know.
Right. Right.
I talk about showing appreciation because many relationships absolutely die from emotional undernourishment.
Yes.
Because people forget to say what they value,
yes,
and what they appreciate about their partner.
Yes.
So
and that's what
up,
it gets us back,
you know,
to the whole, you know, I thank you and I love you. Well, I love you is a wonderful thing, and
mm-hmm,
it's nice to hear. But if I say, you know, what you just did, I want to thank you for what you just did, that sends you a clue, does it not, as my partner? So, oh, he liked when I did that. Oh, I'm going to do that again because I know that he likes it.
It's like reinforcing.
Exactly.
But
so,
you got to speak up about
exactly
it, otherwise they don't have a clue. It's like psychic
right
communication.
Right, right, right. You know? I mean, in somebody said, I'm going to do something really nice for somebody. I'm going to make them their favorite meal. Well, how did we know that that was their favorite meal? Somebody said so. Somebody said,
exactly,
thank you. That was so delicious. That's my favorite thing. So
right,
we're communicating, and, you know, I love you. I mean, I could have easily said, you know, I love you when I got my favorite meal, but
mm-hmm,
that didn't really tell you anything about it.
Right, and you spoke to me off the air about how when you say thank you, it really can transform a relationship,
yeah,
when it's heartfelt.
Yeah.
And I just want to repeat something that you touched on before we go to the break. You said it raises the other up. And again, it gets us out of our ego.
Right.
And people need to do that.
Certainly in a partnership.
Huh?
Certainly in a partnership, in a love
mm-hmm
relationship, whatever. It's letting the other one know that, you know, you're not running the whole show. You know, I mean, I am who I am because I am with you. So thank you for that.
Oh, yes, because there are those mirror neurons even in the brain where we can, if we're with somebody long enough, we really become more like the other.
Yes.
And, yeah, when we're in a good relationship, it can make all the difference. There's no question about it. So we're going to go to our break, and when we come back, Dr. Richard Wagner and I will switch gears. We'll talk about BDSM and aftercare and how that can make a difference, because it's also about gratitude. So we have lots more to talk about, so please stay with us, and we'll be right back. Yes, Dr. Diana Wiley back with Dr. Richard Wagner. Well, a study was published last year in the Journal of Sexual Medicine, and researchers surveyed people who practice BDSM, that's bondage and discipline, sadomasochism, and found that they were more extroverted, open to experience, and conscientious than those who didn't. They also reported a higher overall well-being. Who knew? Because a lot of people think that if you think about whips, chains, handcuffs in the bedroom, you know, you may not think that this is necessarily a super healthy sex life. Now, my colleague, Dr. Serena McKenzie, who's a naturopath and an expert in sexual medicine, and Richard, you know her too.
Sure.
She's an ASEX certified sex counselor, and this is a quote from her. And I have worked with her for about 5 years now, and we collaborate with patients, and she's a wonderful woman and very insightful. Anyway, here's her quote. People who practice BDSM tend to prioritize sex. They make time for it. They're accepting of their sexuality. And they communicate openly with their partner. And, you know, since BDSM isn't quite mainstream, although I think 50 Shades of Grey probably helped. It may take people a while to come to terms, most people, with their sexuality. So They've given their sexual preferences a lot of thought and actively discussed these preferences with their partners. Doesn't that ring true for you in your experience with clients and in your perhaps even your personal experience?
It is. It is precisely that. We mentioned at the top of the hour my latest book, The Gospel of Kink.
Yes, and I would like you to explain that book a little bit because we'll get people to go and get it.
Right. Good. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Anyhow, I chose that title specifically. First of all, it's really an edgy title, and I'm not interested in just being provocative, although God knows I like being provocative.
Well, and it sells books.
It does. And the word gospel, for anyone who has the least bit of information about Christianity, is basically just the good news.
Mm-hmm.
It's the good news of kink. And I think that, you know, kink and power play and BDSM are all ways of expressing oneself sexually and sometimes non-sexually, but still very physically. And so, and I would say that BDSM is a kink, but not all kinks are BDSM. The same way that BDSM is power play, but not all power play is BDSM. So I just throw that out to you.
But expand on it a little bit. Maybe you're about to.
Okay. So, again, you mentioned BDSM means bondage, discipline, sadomasochism.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an exchange of power that I, as a sub, would relinquish my control to you as the dominant, or you as the dominant invite me to relinquish control as the sub. There's passive and active, and dominant and submissive. And
yeah.
This is power play. And it can be physical. It can be psychological. It can be both. We do this. A lot of people, vanilla people, as the alternative are identified, they often have elements of this. I mean, I know real vanilla folks who, you know, are happy to slap one of their partner on the butt, you know, during sex play, or pull hair, or, you know, bite, and all that kind of stuff. That's power play.
That's sure.
Can be BDSM, at least a light version of it. So it's not as freaky as we think. I mean, there's lots of people who have fetishes. We talked about cross-dressing in the last half hour.
Mm-hmm.
There's fetishes about shoes and body types and, you know, big breasts and, you know, big penises and red hair and all these wonderful fetishes that, you know, people have, leather and latex and rubber and all kinds of things. I mean, we are such creative people. I mean, we have this capacity as humans, you know, our mind, like Dr. Kinsey said, you know, our biggest sex organ is between our ears. And it's true.
It's,
you know,
true.
We have all of this capacity to, you know, make life and our sex life and our loving as interesting and unique as possible. So, but the problem in our society is that anything that ventures just off the norm, you know, even like swinging or multiple partners or polyamory or any of these kinds of things, you know, the people who are involved in this are often ostracized or cut off from the larger community.
Yeah.
And sometimes they're victimized for, you know, their fetishes or their alternative lifestyles. And so that was in the forward of my mind when I created this workshop, which is I call The Gospel of Kink. And then I created the after I created the workshop, I decided that I would make a book form of it. And it's actually a workbook. And so that, you know, people can, you know, do all the exercises that I put my live clients through in the workshop when you are reading the book at home.
And you did that with your other book, The Amateur's Guide
right.
to Deaf and Dying,
exactly.
And it's very helpful. And I'm just paging. I don't have the Gospel of Kink, but I am going to get it because I would have had it before this interview. But I'm going to be visiting my 92-year-old mother who, you know, is in pretty good shape for her age, but I'm going to take this book of yours because I think I want to give it to her. It's just so rich and wonderful. And if she could have some help by listening to the archive version from last year of our show about this, she's technologically not able to do that, but with my brother's help or somebody's help, she could do it. Because it's, I think lots of people, just to digress for a moment, could be really helped as they approach the end of life by being more aware. And you bring this up. So there's so much more awareness. So you have this workbook and the Gospel of Kink. So let's go back to that.
Okay. So the Gospel of Kink is has a built-in 10-person on-the-page workshop group. And
mm-hmm.
these are fictional characters, but they're based on real people that, you know, I've worked with. And they go and do all the exercises, and you read along with them and, you know, get enriched by their insights and their troubles and their difficulties and how they manage things. And it's basically an opportunity. The workbook itself is a primer on how to talk, how to communicate, and how to build relationships for the alt lifestyle crowd. And there's just not a lot of that kind of stuff out there. There's lots and lots of mainstream things about how to make your marriage this and, you know, how to make your love life that and all this kind of stuff. But there's less stuff available for kinksters. And I thought, you know, well, if we talk directly to, you know, kinksters and let them talk to us about their life and how they live it and the problems that they encounter and how they navigate, you know, the pitfalls of their relationships, I think we'll be the richer for it. I mean, even, you know, vanilla folks would learn a lot from, you know, reading through the Gospel of Kink.
Well, and some vanilla folk want to move on.
Yes.
If they're in long-term relationships, to bring a little kink into their lives to help spice it up.
Right.
And, yes, and now in our conversation yesterday, Richard, you talked about, so BDSM aftercare.
Right.
So you've got the scene, you have a discussion about the scene, and I want you to please expand on all of this, the play itself, and then the aftercare, which has to do with a transition from your personality in the scene to your day-to-day personality.
Right.
So for
folks
yeah.
who don't know anything about power play,
mm-hmm.
It's a system, for lack of a better word. It's two people, or maybe more, decide on what the parameters of their play is going to be, and we call that the negotiation phase. That's
mm-hmm.
the first open parentheses, the negotiation. What are we going to do? What are our safe words? What are our limits? How are we going to play this out? All the necessary things. What do you like? What should I avoid? All of this kind of stuff. So That gets us to how we began this discussion on this half hour about talking about sexual things.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of vanilla folk don't talk about stuff, and so
That's right.
Poorer for it. But kinksters do. They have to because,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's no assuming that, you know, somebody's going to like this or want that. So, and then there's the play itself, whatever period of time that is. It could be an hour, it could be 2 hours, it could be 24/7. Some people live power play 24/7. And then afterwards, the ending parentheses or the closing parentheses is called aftercare. So that is when, after the play is over, and sometimes this can be very vigorous play, both physically and psychologically, and there's an opportunity for the players to embrace, to say thank you, to, you know, come down off of the experience that they've just had. And it's a wonderful thing. It would be a wonderful thing to build into regular sex play, would it not?
Absolutely. And as you've already referred to, many vanilla people just don't have very good sexual communication.
Yes.
And it's unfortunate. Sometimes I call it psychic sex.
Yes.
You know, so many folks believe, if you really loved me, you should know. And I say, you know, it's like going on a treasure hunt without any clues.
Yes.
Because you've got to have communication.
Right.
And so I think that a lot of BDSM folks are ahead of the game because they've got these rituals built in.
Yes.
For really good, clear communication about
right.
boundaries, and all that you've just described.
Right. And wouldn't it be wonderful if it was part and parcel of, you know, more sex play, you know, for more people? And just instead of assuming, you know, well,
mm-hmm.
this worked last time, or she liked this the last time I did it, maybe I should check in. Is this what you're up for today? You know, would you like something different? Instead of sex, would you much rather have a back rub? And then, do you want to try something different? You know, how do we introduce new things? Most, as you suggest, most people find it difficult to introduce new things because they don't have a vocabulary for it.
You know, precisely, they don't.
And they have no skills at talking about things, even things that they like. You know, like
well. That's where seeing a sex therapist can be useful because
yes.
we as sex therapists do have the vocabulary and we'll bring it out in the session and use the words and model it. And then I give my clients articles to read, which I really like to hear if they benefited from this and how it resonated for them. And then I will loan them sex education DVDs and some I've narrated. For the Sinclair Institute, so, and that can generate a lot of discussion. But
Absolutely.
So many couples need a little help in getting started, right?
Yes, and you know, if I have shame about what my sexual proclivities are,
mm-hmm.
then of course that's going to get in the way. And because the dominant culture, you know, doesn't give people a great deal of latitude about how they can express themselves. A lot of people, you know, just live lives of quiet desperation because they, you know,
yes.
can't say. They are fearful of saying. And, you know, and sometimes, you know, it's a difficult conversation to have. But to avoid it is, you know, just being dishonest with yourself and robbing yourself of something that you're entitled to.
So haven't you seen in your practice, in your years of experience, transformations in people when they can override the shame and begin to communicate more
oh, sure.
clearly and
oh, yes.
experience the joy of their sexuality?
Right. You know, just it becomes a celebration. Talk about gratitude again. I mean,
yeah.
that's
oh,
where we are.
Oh, good. We're going to circle it back. I
know,
love this.
You know, being grateful for, you know, even if you don't understand me, even if you don't accept, you know, where I want to be in my life, sitting and listening to me and taking me seriously, I'm eternally grateful for that. If you join
that's,
me or
that's
not.
That's a lovely that's, idea, and it's so true. Just listening.
Yeah. And taking
mm-hmm.
me serious.
Yeah. Yes. Just listening, and if you can combine that with your loved one of not only listening, paying attention, but also some touching.
Mm-hmm.
And you certainly found that out with your work with the dying people,
mm-hmm.
death and dying, how eager they were just to be touched and
right.
held. Well,
right.
most people are, if they don't have it in their lives particularly, they want to be touched and held.
Yes.
So sitting...
And not in a clinical sort of way, because that's the kind of touch that most people get at the end of their life. You know, it's clinical. It's, you know, I'm
mm-hmm.
poking and prodding and doing this and doing that. And
mm-hmm.
it looks like I'm ministering to you. It looks like I'm, you know, being kind to you. But it's really clinical, and it's not loving. It doesn't come from the heart. It comes from, you know, like this is a job that I got to do. And sometimes, you know, caregivers, even if they're, you know, in the primary relationship, like a husband and wife, you know, if they're caregivers, sometimes the touching becomes very clinical and not loving, and that's what's really missing in, you know, as people are sick or as they age, is that, you know, that loving touch goes away, and what is sometimes it's replaced by clinical touch or no touch at all.
Precisely, and for years I've had this idea that very old ladies often get their hair done a lot.
Yes.
Because it's a legitimate
exactly.
way to be touched.
Exactly that.
Yeah,
they
get
that.
Their heads massaged.
Right.
But so maybe we can tie this back in to Thanksgiving. And so for those of you who are listening, at Thanksgiving, you may encounter some older relatives, perhaps a grandmother, but other older relatives. I think it would be a wonderful thing to express appreciation
right.
for the older person with a hug and with some hand-holding. And, you know, I was thinking about, because Brian and I are, my fiancé and I are going to a big Thanksgiving. And they, you know, it's typical to go around the table and say, I'm thankful for.
Right.
And I'm thinking that I'm thankful for my grandmothers. They were born in 1888 and 1889, respectively.
Mm.
And they were very authentic women. One was a really renowned artist, a sculptress, and the other was a businesswoman. And they were very different, but they taught me that women are real human beings, not idealized, one-dimensional accessories,
yes, right.
very real human beings. And I'm so grateful for my grandmothers who gave me these messages.
And modeled it for you so that
and
you
modeled
could do that
it.
Yourself.
And they were, you know, they
add.
Like the one grandmother marched for women's vote
yes.
in 1912. So they were forerunners. I'm grateful for that. So to think right. about what you're grateful for, but if there are old people at your Thanksgiving celebrations, be sure and spend some time with them. They'll be so appreciative, don't you
yeah.
think, Richard?
I do. And, you know, old people are told, you know, to be unobtrusive and stay out of the way, and
mm-hmm.
and they're discounted and stuff like that. I mean, any effort to show a little kindness, a little gratitude.
Yes.
Just to whisper in somebody's ear, you know, you changed my life when you did this.
Yes.
When you were there, you changed my life.
Yes.
What a profound gift that is.
That's a profound gift. You
and
changed
only you
my
can
life.
Give it.
Right.
Right. Exactly.
I think this has been a very inspirational show. We have a few more minutes, but I'm so grateful for you, Richard, because
Thank you.
Of what you have said. I mean, these sorts of inspirational words need to go out there. We need to be grateful, as I said earlier. You know, I say prayers of gratitude. Thank you, by the way, is a two-word prayer, but it's very powerful, isn't it?
Right. Thank you. Especially if it's backed up by authenticity.
Yes, authenticity. And living it out. I think I might have mentioned this when we spoke last year on the air, but, you know, I've been widowed for a number of years, and I'm, of course, grateful that I now have a new relationship. But after Charlie died, I was appreciative of the fact that we had said it all, we had done it all,
yes.
And I didn't have regrets about, if only we had.
Right.
I mean, to die at 57 was just so premature, and it was unexpected, and it was shattering and all of that. But we had had a full marriage, and I was so grateful for that. And it changed me, living it, and then after his death. And
well, it does. I mean,
yes.
That's how we started the show. I mean, that gratitude changes us. It gets us out of ourselves, you know, gets us free of our selfishness and our sense of entitlement, and that other people are the ones who fulfill us. They, you know, they come into our lives. Sometimes it's a bad encounter, but it is impactful nonetheless, and it makes something good happen.
Richard, we're hearing the music for a reason, because I neglected to tell you or remind you that we need to stop a few minutes before the top of the hour. So we have done a show, I think a great pre-Thanksgiving show, and I do thank you so much.
All the best of the holiday to you, my dear.
Thank you, and to you, and I hope that we'll have a part two in the beginning of the new year. So stay tuned, everybody. Thanks again, Richard.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.